We will take up this chapter, The Philosophy of Rebirth. We have done perhaps the first six paragraphs, but I'm sure we have lost track of what is happening. It is important to remember, or at least to know in the beginning, why is Sri Aurobindo talking about the philosophy of rebirth when more or less in India we accept this concept of rebirth. But why is he taking pains to give it a full chapter, and not only one but a couple of them, to establish this theory of rebirth? Obviously there are many theories or many philosophies and maybe religious views which do not accept the need for rebirth. So in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo would, as usual, take up each of those philosophies and see what are their major beliefs regarding rebirth, and at the same time point out the deficiency of these philosophies if they do not accept the concept of rebirth, and ultimately come to his own theory, not as an explanation but more as a conclusion. You see, that's the beauty in Sri Aurobindo, that he will never force his view upon the readers. He kind of brings us to his view. So he takes us through such logical process that ultimately we almost see what Sri Aurobindo wants to say, and then when he says that, we readily accept it. Because it's a logical process. It's not a kind of a declaration saying that I believe and so must you. That's not the way he does. The whole of Life Divine is a kind of a logical explanation on the mental level of metaphysical truths. So in the beginning, as we have seen, he takes up the view of the material hypothesis, because what does the materialist believe regarding rebirth? Although, as it says in the previous paras, that man has innately within him a sense of something that is there before his life and something that would be there hereafter. So the entire philosophic question, if not the entire, a major part of philosophic question is what was before birth and what shall be after birth. So it is in this review of before and hereafter that Sri Aurobindo argues there's different views, and the first view that he takes up is that of the material hypothesis. We have seen that more or less that they believe that there's nothing after the dissolution of the body. The whole body relapses into matter, and the so-called drive of man towards establishing his name, leaving behind his name as a famous one, etc., is only a kind of a collective effort. So the name and the fame may stay for a while, and even that gets wiped off in time. Then he goes on to the other theories, which are, as he calls them, the religious myth and dogmatic mystery of God. I mean, these are religious views which really believe that it is God who creates bodies and then breathes life into these bodies. So what happens when they say breathing life into the body means it is kind of injecting the soul into the body. And then this body lives upon earth for a few years, then it dies. But then what happens to the soul? That's the question. Because the soul that comes in time, that means the moment it is creation, that means we call it in time. A soul which comes to birth in time in a particular body must end when that body is gone. So the soul is not immortal. Then he has other questions about if a soul is kind of thrust into a body, and a body which has its own body, mind and life, its own personality, its own strength and weakness, then the soul ultimately is punished or rewarded according to the way it has treated with this body. But then the question is, the soul says, I have not asked for such a body. The body has been thrust upon me. So why do you hold me responsible and give me the punishment and the reward? So that's the question that really comes in the question, on the way of this religious myth and the religious beliefs. Then of course he would take up the question of the third view, where there is a temporary creation of the soul. That means there are views which tell us that with the birth of the body the soul comes in, and with the death of the body the soul goes away. But goes away where? So that means there are some other subtle physical worlds also besides the physical. So Sri Aurobindo argues that the moment you say it goes away, does it go away back to the Supreme? No. Then where does it go and rest? Well, there is this Pythagorean philosophy which says of transmigration. Because Pythagoras could not solve this question of the different subtle worlds, he said the soul goes from one body to another, it's called the transmigration, immediately. But that's not very satisfying. So this question of the other worlds, the other subtle physical worlds, comes into being, that we have to believe that there are other worlds apart from this physical. So there is a question, again, is are there these subtle physical worlds after the birth of the soul, after the soul leaves the body? Or could it be possible that the soul comes into the body from the subtle physical worlds, stays in the body for a few years, and then goes back to the subtle physical worlds? So there are some of these possibilities. And then he takes up another major view of Buddhism, which he called the vital becoming. That means what we have seen in the basic philosophy of Buddhism, that of the flux, that is continuous stream of energy. So where is the question of rebirth? But on the contrary, Buddhists believe very strongly in rebirth. So who is reborn? When we say rebirth, rebirth of what or by whom? They say there is nothing called of or by. It is a rebirth of karma. And karma are the sensations, the reasons, what you do in this life. They themselves kind of form a formulation. Well, we'll see the details of those words later. He would call it, you know, a mental consciousness associated. It's more an image of the karma which really comes back into the next life. So although Buddhism believes in rebirth, it does not believe in the rebirth of the soul as such. It is the rebirth of your karma which formulates itself into a kind of a amorphous form. Then of course he takes up another major philosophy of Advaita Shankara, where there is obviously the question of rebirth. But if you press Shankara apart, then there is a question of there is rebirth, but only apparently. It is only an illusion. In fact, he has used a wonderful phrase, I forget it now, it is, he says it's very effective or deceptive or something. A deceptive means, but an effective way. The meaning is, Shankara would talk about this rebirth, the soul coming back, etc., etc., but ultimately, even Shankara says all this is a question of illusion. The universe, the birth, the rebirth, the creation itself is illusion. So he says all this is illusion. So you see, we have another problem of rebirth. There is a rebirth, but ultimately there's no rebirth because all this is an illusion. Then he takes up the Advaita Vedanta. And in the Advaita Vedanta, we have a very positive role for rebirth. That means that the world, that the universe is real. It is a creation of Brahman. Advaita Vedanta would tell us. So rebirth is a reality. And it's a reality based on two things. One on desire and the other on ignorance. Because of our desires, we take a rebirth. Because of our ignorance, we come back to this world. But then Advaita Vedanta would say, the day you are beyond these desires and away from this ignorance, you get back to the Supreme. So it is a kind of a leela for Advaita Vedanta. It is a leela. The whole world is a leela, a game in which souls come, take birth, and then as long as I have desire, I take a new birth, etc., etc., etc. But then Sri Aurobindo says, is that just an empty play? Is there no purpose in this? No, for the Vedantin, there is no ultimate purpose in this rebirth. It's because you are attached to a desire, you are compelled to come back. So you see, you have the Sankhya Yoga and Yoga and Vedanta and all these yoga systems which tell you, which show you how to come out of this ignorance. And then once you come out of this ignorance, you go back to the Brahman and there you are released. So Sri Aurobindo asks the question, then what is the purpose? Is it just because you have been cursed with the desire and ignorance that you are compelled? So you see, we have a whole gamut of the theories of philosophy, of rebirth. None of them, some of them we see soul is temporary. In some we see soul comes, an eternal thing that comes into body, and then we don't know what happens to that, because they don't believe that there are other worlds. And then Buddha, of course, there's no soul. Shankara, of course, as we see, he says it's all an illusion. And even Advaita Vedanta would not give us this view of what is the purpose. Then Sri Aurobindo brings in the question, his own answer, of why is there the necessity of rebirth? So he goes a step farther than the Advaita Vedanta to tell us that it is, rebirth becomes necessary, is a fact, sure, but it becomes a necessary fact for the evolution of the spiritual man. You see again how the whole question comes back to the concept of evolution, which is the central key to Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. So if there's no evolutionary purpose, even rebirth has no meaning. Our countless coming back, okay, we have, even the Advaita would agree, that right from the animal stage the soul has come to the level of man, and in the level of man it awakens to itself, it knows what is God, etc., etc. But then it does not say about this evolutionary concept. So in Sri Aurobindo we see now for the first time the meaning, the need and the necessity of rebirth is because as the soul has come from a million births towards human being, it now wants to go towards a higher future. The past has been, as the Sri Aurobindo calls it here, human evolution. But then he says this future is belonging to the suprahumanity. So he says just as it has come from the past to human level, now from the human level it has to go to the superhuman level, that the supramatter. It is because of this growth of the spiritual man that the rebirth becomes an absolute necessity. So take away the evolution to spiritual man, then we don't need rebirth. When, as a concept we don't need, but we do take a rebirth because of this ignorance and desire, etc. But there's no purpose. There's no kind of a raison d'être for rebirth. This happening is a fact. We all say it's a fact. Fine, finish. But why of the fact, on the Sri Aurobindo has answered. So you see, this is again, I gave you kind of a gist of this chapter to bring to your attention that how Sri Aurobindo has to deal with this problem of rebirth, again from his own point of evolution of the spiritual man and the culmination in the superman. You see, the whole of the life divine now you can understand, every chapter is moving towards the absolute inevitability of the superman. That's the whole growth. So he's not writing all this to explain Indian philosophy and Western philosophy. Why should he do that? There are plenty of books to do all that. But he's kind of clearing up all misconceptions, clearing up all notions, be it illusion, be it world, be it man, be it rebirth, be it society, everything he is doing, only to show us the inevitability of the coming of the new race, the supramental race. And that's how slowly he goes toward from all this, and then ultimately he lands in the evolution of the spiritual man, and then he ends up with a Gnostic personality and the Gnostic life itself. So you see, there is a rhythm, a meaning, a logic even in this chapterization. So I suppose now you get the logical understanding of this chapter, the summary idea I've given you. Once you know that, then perhaps we can get into the details. Today I should take up the reading from paragraph 7, if you have marked them. But the paragraph begins with the immortality or eternity of the soul does not at once impose itself, even if we reject the explanation of all things by eternal matter. For we have also the hypothesis of the creation of a temporary or apparent soul by some power of the original unity from which all things began, by which they live and into which they cease. Well, I suppose now you can see which is the theory, the third one, of the temporary existence of a soul. This is the third one. If you want to mark it, you could do that very well. You know, paragraph beginning with the first question is whether the before and the after is the first argument, that is the material hypothesis. And then the second one is just below that. One of these is the old religious myth and dogmatic mystery, is the second argument. And now in para 7, we have the third argument. So here, so what he has said about the question of the temporary or apparent soul by some power of the original unity. So creation of the soul by some supreme power, but only for a temporary purpose. On one side, we can erect upon the foundation of certain modern ideas or discoveries the theory of a cosmic inconscient creating a temporary soul, a consciousness which after a brief play is extinguished and goes back into the consciousness, into the inconscient. Or there may be an eternal becoming which manifests itself in a cosmic life force with the appearance of matter as one objective end of its operations and the appearance of mind as the other subjective end, the interaction of these two phenomena of life force creating our human existence. So within this question of the temporary or apparent soul, there are some options. There are some, you know, there are three different thoughts. One is that the soul is thrown up by the inconscient. Creating a temporary soul for a brief play in this life. But after the body is dead, the soul goes back into the inconscient. So that is one possibility. Or the second one is the superconscient one. That the divine himself, what Sri calls here, the eternal becoming, creates this soul, and of which, you know, there is a play between life, vital and matter, life and mind. And then afterwards, again it goes back to the Supreme. So the soul comes in only for a particular life, then either it goes into the superconscient or into the inconscient. There is a third option. On the other side, we have the old theory of a soul existing superconscient, an eternal unmodifiable being, which admits or creates by maya and illusion of individual soul life in the world of phenomenal mind and matter, both of them ultimately unreal, even if they have or assume a temporary or phenomenal reality, since one unmodifiable and eternal self or spirit is the only entity. So this is of course a little different version of the eternal becoming, that is the theory of Shankara. Here we are getting the hint of Shankara, that we have this individual soul life in this world of phenomenal matter, both of them ultimately unreal. That's what I was explaining about Shankaracharya. He does give reality to the birth of the soul, but then, as I said, if you go far into Shankara, then he ends up saying, I'm sorry, all this explanation is only to tell you this is only an illusion. So that has been the bane of Shankara's philosophy. It is marvelous in its logic. I mean, almost if I can use the word impeccable. On the logical level, you cannot quite argue with it. It's so very well founded in a logical question and answer. But then, ultimately, if you ask the single question that who gets this moksha or the release, then Shankaracharya fumbles as if. Because if you say it is the soul that gets the moksha, the release, that means the soul is a reality. I mean an eternal reality. A birth is an eternal reality. But if you say that this birth is an eternal reality, then the world is an eternal reality. The creation is a reality. But if you say the creation is a reality, then the entire philosophy of Shankara comes to naught. So he's caught in his own logic. And then somehow he escapes this question which was first put by Ramanujacharya and now by Sri Aurobindo. He escapes this by saying, oh, all this is maya. So maya is for him an escape route. is not a logical answer. Then you say, what is Maya? Then it says, anirvachaneya, finished, is indescribable. It is not, it exists, it does not exist, and it confuses you further so that you don't have any chance to ask any more questions. Then it's okay, Shankaracharya, get going. We'll wait until Sri Aurobindo comes and tells us the secret. So that is the kind of the argument of the Mayavadi. So that is what Sri Aurobindo is telling us. So it is reality, mind and matter, but ultimately both are unreal. Even if they have or assume a temporary and phenomenal reality. So Shankara's thing is, this world is real as long as you are in it. That means, when you are dreaming, you don't say that the dream is unreal. You enjoy the dream and you are the good or the bad in the dream. You think it's all real. But in the morning, when you wake up with a blast near your door, then suddenly you say, hey, all that was a dream. That means it was non-existent. So here too, it says, you are living in this world, enjoying it, all the papam and the punyam and the sad and the sorrow and all that. But one day when you realize the Brahman, then you say, oh my God, all this was nothing but a dream. So this is where he really gives the world a temporary and phenomenal reality. So if I can put it this way, the world is real until the point when you realize it unreal. That's Shankara. And if you want to come to the point of realizing that it is unreal, he says you have to do Jnana Yoga, leave the works, because works are the worst thing, they bind you to the world. Because the more involved you are in the karma, the more you think the world is reality. But Jnana Marga is one that already gives you the sense of illusion, because through meditation, etc., you can withdraw and say, no, the world is after all not that real. With the sense of the unreal or the unreality of the world you get in meditation. So he prefers the Jnana Marga, because that's what he wants you to do, leave the world. So that's the second one. And then he said the third one, the other alternative, or we have the Buddhist theory of a nihil or nirvana, and somehow impose upon that an eternal action or energy of successive becoming, karma, which creates the illusion of a persistent self or soul of a constant continuity of associations, ideas, memories, sensations, images. This is extremely interesting to know. I mean, these are all alternatives. We are not really dealing with Buddha and Shankara as such, but we are still in the third argument, remember? Creation of temporary souls. So in the Buddha also we see, he says, we are reborn, but what is reborn is the soul, but not the soul that we know of as part of the divine. But a soul which is kind of made up of, it's a package of associations, ideas, memories, sensations and images. So it's an amorphous conglomeration of my sensations, of my experiences, my karmas, my memories. So when you go into next life, you may be carrying the memories of your previous life. That is what is actually the essence of Jatakas. The Buddhist Jatakas, when he can recount to you hundreds and thousands of his previous births. Because he says, in our every rebirth, the past package of memories comes back. Not that we remember it so easily, but at a point of nirvanic experience, you do get that memory. In fact, if you have read that exact description of Buddha's nirvana, actually, what does it describe? It doesn't describe the Brahman or the illumination or the Purushottama or something like that. He just says how he has got memory of his past births. Then he traces his own evolution. Evolution not in our Sri Aurobindonian sense, but evolution in the sense of birth to birth, what he has been doing upon this earth. And that is why we have the Jataka stories. So that clarity of his past brings him that what is called the enlightenment. So that's what is the important thing. We have associations, ideas, memories, etc., which is the real soul. And in their effect upon the life problem, all these three explanations are practically one. For even the superconscient is for the purposes of the universal action an equivalent of the inconscient. It can be aware only of its own unmodifiable self-existence. The creation of a world of individual beings by Maya is an imposition on this self-existence. It takes place perhaps in a sort of self-absorbed sleep of consciousness, susupti, out of which yet all active consciousness and modification of phenomenal becoming emerge, just as in the modern theory our consciousness is an impermanent development out of the inconscient. Well, here, as you can understand, it brings in a conclusion, a summary of all this theory that we have seen of the inconscient, of the superconscient, of the Buddha and of Shankara. So therefore he says that all these three theories, so all these three explanations are practically one. They are all practically one because they all tell you about the temporality of the soul. Be it an illusion, be it a kind of an imposition by Maya that this is a world that is true, etc. He says it doesn't matter in what way they come, but all of them end up by saying that the soul is a temporary thing. Well, there's a line here that you should understand perhaps. The creation of a world of individual being by Maya is an imposition on this self-existence. It takes place perhaps in a sort of self-absorbed sleep of consciousness, susupti. You see a note there at the bottom of the page. Prajna of the Mandukya Upanishad, the self situated in the deep sleep is the Lord and Creator of things. So here he says, susupti, out of which yet all active consciousness and modification of phenomenal being becoming emerge. This is a line you should understand in the light of Shankaracharya, that we have, because there is a question that Ramanuja asks him, of course Ramanuja comes much later, but this is philosophical debates, that how could the Brahman create, first of all, because he cannot create, cannot in the sense of, not in the sense of incapacity, cannot in the sense of, that if he does so, he is not Brahman. Because Brahman is a nirguna, he is a stable, he cannot divide himself. That which divides itself cannot be reality. So that which is indivisible, so for Shankara, that is the Brahman. And the moment you say you create, that means like a woman gives birth to a child, she creates out of her womb, but she gives to the child a part of her own self. So this is kind of a separating a little bit of her own womb into the child. So that means it is a division. And it says Brahman, if he creates out of his own being a world, that means he cannot be that so-called indivisible Brahman. And not only indivisible, but nirguna. One who has no qualities. Here is a qualification that he can create a beautiful or an ugly world, whatever. So that's a qualification. So that becomes that he is not nirguna. So here it says that the world has been created, the individual has been created when the Supreme was in a susupti state. Susupti, as we have seen, is the self-absorbed sleep of consciousness. You see, these are things that go against Shankara himself. That in the susupti stage, he says, Maya created, as if Maya imposed itself. You know, the description actually is, and if there is this Brahman consciousness, then Maya kind of, you know, veils him. And then Brahman is there beyond the Maya, and is the Maya which veils, and is Maya which creates this universe. So it is always the Brahman is not even aware of this world, because there is this parda, this wall, this veil of Maya. But then the question is, from where did the Maya come? Because there is only one reality called Brahman. Where is the other reality of Maya, which has the power even to veil the Brahman consciousness and kind of, you know, hide him, so that Maya says, whatever I do, you don't know. So these are the, that's why when it says, it is given in the state of Sushupti, can the divine be really in the sleep consciousness where he is not aware of what's happening? So see, these are the arguments that come in. Well, however, here Sri Aurobindo is not arguing, he is just telling us the phenomena as represented by the Advaita Vedanta. This Mayavadin philosophy. In all three theories, the apparent soul or spiritual individuality of the creature is not immortal in the sense of eternity, but has a beginning and an end in time, is a creation by Maya or by nature force or cosmic action out of the inconscient or superconscient, and is therefore impermanent in its existence. In all three, rebirth is either unnecessary or is illusory. It is either the prolongation of repetition of an illusion, or it is an additional revolving wheel among the many wheels of the complex machinery of becoming, or it is excluded, since a single birth is all that can be asked for by a conscious being fortuitously engendered as part of an inconscient creation. So this is what Sri Aurobindo wants to conclude, that all this theory, be it the material theory, the religious theory, or the temporary creation, all of them land up in the same thing, that either the soul is temporary, is impermanent, or else if there is rebirth, it is unnecessary or else illusory. Illusory we have seen with the Shankaracharya, it is illusory. And it is unnecessary because we have seen in the Buddha's philosophy that there is no question of the soul, is unnecessary. But what Sri Aurobindo wants to use this argument is to establish the first understanding of rebirth, that either it is unnecessary for some philosophies, and in some philosophies if it is there, it is illusory. And now he will take up, of course, there is one paragraph still about Buddhism, and then there is a para on the modern views, etc. Yeah, we can read one more para that brings us to the second major argument. I'll take up now the next para 8. In these views, whether we suppose the one eternal existence to be a vital becoming, or an immutable and unmodifiable spiritual being, or a nameless and formless non-being, that which we call the soul can be only a changing mass or stream of phenomena of consciousness which has come into existence in the sea of real or illusory becoming and will cease to exist there, or it may be is a temporary spiritual substratum, a conscious reflection of the superconscient eternal, which by its presence supports the mass of phenomena. But this is, as we said earlier, this is an explanation of the Buddhist theory. Now in that we see what Sri Aurobindo calls it the vital becoming. The vital becoming, try to understand that, is a very important word that he has coined here. Vital becoming is, it is the vital, that means full of this, as you have seen, associations, ideas, memories, sensations and images, they belong to the vital. So he is saying it is this vital which forms a kind of a substratum and which comes from birth after birth in a new body. So he has a very meaningful coinage of word there, vital becoming. It is not the soul becoming, it is the vital which continuously becomes. So getting back to that, whether we suppose the one eternal to be a vital becoming, or an immutable, unmodifiable spiritual being, or a nameless and formless non-being, that which we call the soul can only be a changing mass or stream of phenomena of consciousness. So according to this Buddhism also, the whole thing, whatever we want to call it, is a changing mass or stream of phenomena of consciousness. What does it mean? That like we believe the soul is a consistent body, here in Buddhism it doesn't have a consistent body, it is a stream of phenomena of consciousness. You know, we have the modern theory of the stream of consciousness. In Buddhism, the soul itself is a stream of consciousness. So when you say a stream of consciousness, even the soul itself is constantly changing. It doesn't have a permanent body. Well, in our philosophy, the soul is not changing, is evolving. There's a difference in that. So for them, that's a word that he uses later, it is a temporary spiritual substratum, a conscious reflection of the superconscious eternal, which by its presence supports the mass of phenomena. So it is a temporary spiritual substratum. So the soul is not an entity. It is made of a substance, and the contents of the substance is nothing but sensations, the memories, ideas, images. You see, in this life I may have some kind of experiences, I may have some kind of images, I may have some kind of associations, relationship with people. All this will change my soul substance. But in our theory, all these things do not change the substance of the soul. So you see, the soul's substance is the vital becoming. So that's the important word with Buddhism, it's a vital becoming, of which the substance is constantly changing, because the contents themselves are changing. So here it says, it is not eternal, and its only immortality is a greater or less continuity in the becoming. So the only immortality of the soul, the so-called soul, not the real soul, please remember, the soul of Buddhism is a constant becoming. Is a continuity in the becoming. That means it keeps on taking birth after birth, birth after birth. So Heraclitus said the same thing like the Buddha. What is eternal is change. He says change is eternity. There is nothing called the eternal. It is the eternal changing which is itself eternity. So similarly he says here, there is a continuity itself is its immortality. It is not a real and always existent person who maintains and experiences a stream of mass of phenomena. That which supports them, that which really and always exists, is either the one eternal becoming, or the one eternal and impersonal being, or the continual stream of energy in its working. I think I will stop there because we don't have time, and I think today you have some program. So I'll take up from there, and then we'll proceed tomorrow.